My name is Dr. John Blumenstein. The course is New Testament Theology. This is cassette number 9, side A. Now we begin to take a look at another section of the canon, Hebrews and the Catholic Epistles. Let's talk just a bit about these epistles and some of the common features that they share and what place they occupy in the canon. Hebrews kind of stands in a category by itself, but we lump it with the so-called Catholic epistles because of where it falls in the structure of the Protestant canon. The Greek Katholikos means universal or general. So when we refer to these as Catholic epistles, we're talking about epistles that are addressed to the church in general. we think of the opening of the book of James to the 12 tribes in the dispersion. Also, these epistles tend to address general or typical problems in the life of the church. It's a lot more difficult to pin down specific situations to which they were written, as is the case with some of Paul's epistles, like Galatians or 2 Timothy, for example. These epistles are identified with the name of the author rather than the name of the recipients. It's interesting to note the order of these epistles in the canon. In Eastern Orthodox Church Bibles, some that I have seen, a Bulgarian New Testament and a Russian Bible as well, I have noticed that the Catholic epistles come after the book of Acts and before the Pauline epistles. You see in these Bibles, the book of James immediately following the book of Acts, and then the Pauline epistles follow the Catholic epistles. It is well known Luther's objection to some of these epistles. Luther took objection to 4 of the writings here. Luther had serious questions about, well, three of these writings in the block we're talking about, Hebrews, James, and Jude. Also, Luther had serious questions about the book of Revelation, and we'll talk about that in some detail, especially with the book of James. The very collection and canonization of these epistles probably reflects a growing concern that the New Testament be understood as universally applicable to the church. Again, we have already noticed that the book of Hebrews kind of stands in a category by itself. Even in the early church, there was a fairly widespread doubt that the book of Hebrews was written by the Apostle Paul. It actually has no author attached to it, and so it ends up falling there in between the Pauline collection and the so-called Catholic epistles. It shares more in common, I think, with the Catholic epistles than it does with the Pauline epistles. As to the form of these writings, there's nothing all that remarkable about the form, except that if you compare them with Paul in the usual Pauline epistolary form, they seem to depart from that pattern, if indeed it's appropriate to see that pattern as a kind of benchmark. The book of Hebrews, which we take up first, just launches right in and has absolutely no standard epistolary opening. There's no greeting, no naming of anybody by way of author or recipients. The writer just launches right into it. In the case of some of these writings, they end rather abruptly. 1 John ends with absolutely no epistolary ending, as we've come to think of it in the case of the Pauline writings. These epistles tend more than Paul to interweave doctrine and ethical instructions constantly throughout. There's a seesawing back and forth. You don't find any of them presenting us with a kind of formal distinction between doctrine and ethical instruction, as is the case at least with Romans and to some extent with Galatians. Again, this suggests something to us of the nature of the relationship between doctrine and ethics, or even more significantly, the New Testament's own assumptions about what constitutes doctrine and the kind of unitary, holistic way in which doctrine and ethics are looked at as part of the same package. Now, Hebrews and James have some semblance of epistolary form, but it's probably best to think of them, as well as some others of the Catholic epistles, as homilies or sermons, kind of extended words of exhortation embedded within an epistolary form. The writer of Hebrews even refers to his writing as a word of exhortation, chapter 13, verse 22. Let us turn now and take a look, first of all, at the book of Hebrews as we begin our journey through these epistles. The book of Hebrews probably did not hurt for a place in the New Testament canon because of some association with Paul in the early church, although many did not believe that it was actually Pauline. Some association with it probably aided its being accepted ultimately into the canon. Very likely, however, this is not a Pauline epistle. It comes to us anonymously and without the usual form and language that we would expect of Paul's epistles. The style of the Greek is quite distinct from what we encounter in the 13 epistles which have Paul's name upon them. The structure of the vocabulary and the theology is very distinct from what we find in those epistles as well. Furthermore, the author speaks like a second-generation author, and Luther noted this in his objection to the epistle, regarding it as non-apostolic because of it. I refer you to the second chapter, verses 3 and 4. There was, nonetheless, some early church attribution of this writing to the Apostle Paul, perhaps in some measure because of the reference to Timothy at the end of the epistle, and some reference to Pauline themes here and there in the epistle. But I like what Moffat has to say in the International Critical Commentary on Hebrews, page number Roman numeral 20. In the introduction, Moffat says, quote, "To us he," that is the author, "is a voice and no more," end quote. We probably would do well simply to admit our ignorance and go on with our theological appreciation of the book. There was some canon controversy, it seems, associated with the book and the life of the early church, and nobody's sure exactly why it shows up variously in canon lists, why it was known in some regions and not others. It's difficult to say. Could be the question of authorship comes into play here. Perhaps the nature of some of the language of this epistle. Nobody's entirely sure exactly why this was the case. In the churches of the East, it was part of the New Testament canon from early on. It was known in the West, but Irenaeus, Tertullian, and Hippolytus did not recognize it as Pauline, along with a number of others, and it was not accepted into the Western canon until relatively later than its wide acceptance in the East. Let's take a look at the overall theological structure and style of this writing. We've already made reference to the unusual opening of the epistle. There is no greeting. The writer simply launches right in. In many and various ways, God spoke of old to our fathers by the prophets, but in these last days he has spoken to us by a Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom also he created the world. He reflects the glory of God and bears the very stamp of his nature, upholding the universe by his word of power. When he had made purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high, having become as much superior to angels as the name he has obtained is more excellent than theirs. Now, this is not at all a typical epistolary opening, at least compared with the Paulines. There's no greeting, naming of an author, addressees, thanksgiving, and so on. Instead, the author jumps right in and establishes a radically Christocentric, Christ-centered focus at the outset, which is quite consistent with the doctrine and theology of this epistle. The body then, we could say, picks up with chapter 1, verse 5, and carries through perhaps to chapter 13, verse 17, or somewhere thereabouts. It's difficult to establish the precise parameters of the body and where the closing begins at the end of the epistle. At the very end, the writer designates the writing a brief letter of exhortation. Again, we note the tight connection between doctrine and exhortation throughout the epistle. There's not a formal divide between doctrine and ethics. Childs, in his introduction to the New Testament as canon, page 416, says, quote, "The doctrine leads to the exhortation, and the exhortation derives from the doctrine." And there's a constant interweaving and cycling of the two all the way throughout the epistle. The closing comes at chapter 13, verses 18 to 25. And here, too, we notice nothing very, very remarkable. There's a call for personal prayer. There's a prayer, some further instructions, some news on Timothy given, some greetings, and the expression of grace. The form of the closing has a strong Pauline flavor. We've already made some reference to that. And more of a typical epistolary form. This only reinforces our sense of the pastoral and practical nature of the doctrine, not to be divorced. The epistle is not to be divorced ultimately from ethics and practice. Now, what can we say about the distinctive theological idiom of this epistle, how it speaks theologically? A preliminary word first might be of order as to the original addressees of this epistle. We, for the most part, avoid issues of background, leaving that to synthesis and survey courses. But there's something that ought to be said in this case that enhances our appreciation of the book theologically. The designation to the Hebrews, pros Hebraeus, is not to be found within the text of the epistle, and is probably based upon inference derived from the epistle itself and added at a later date. Maybe it's a theological construct referring to the Hebrews of old who were part of the ephemeral covenant in contrast with the eternal covenant. It's hard to say. Maybe pros Hebraeus is a reference to the, in some way or another, to the heavily Jewish Old Testament flavor of this book, and the original addressees being Jewish Christians deeply steeped in Old Testament tradition. We notice, based upon references in the epistle, that we can pick up on the problems of these original addressees. Whether we can identify them very precisely or not, it is difficult to identify them ethnically and geographically and chronologically, but we can paint something of a portrait of them based upon references like 2:3, 3:6, 3:14, 10:36-39, 12:12, 12:3-11, 10:25. References such as these suggest an original audience which was facing a kind of general weariness or disheartedness with the Christian faith, perhaps tempted by some sort of Gnostic tendencies here and there, and certainly tempted with a tendency to fall back, redemptive historically speaking, to turn back the clock and go back to the old ways and some of the Jewish practices, not content with what God has done in Jesus Christ. We notice as a kind of aside that the style of this book is excellent in the original language, a style equaled only by Luke in our New Testament, in the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts. We've got something close also in some aspects of the style of 1 Peter in the original language. But there's a radically Christocentric tone set by the introduction to the epistle that we have already read, and the Christology of this epistle is fairly straightforward. There's nothing very subtle to be teased out in its presentation of Christ. In short, the epistle emphasizes throughout the superiority of Christ in his person and work. Christ is superior, better. There's a Greek word that is used some 13 times to emphasize this notion of superiority, kreton, K-R-E-I-T-T-O with a long O mark over it, N. Christ is superior. We want to look at the ways in which the superiority of Christ is presented in the epistle. Also, the writer emphasizes the once-for-all nature of Christ's work. Christ in his person and work is superior, and what he has done is sufficient once and for all in his death and sacrifice, using the adverbs hapax and ephabax in the Greek. And I refer you to 9:28 and 7:27. Christ is superior in every way. And there are three basic areas of superiority that we can classify here in the treatment of the theological idiom of this epistle. And all of these areas are embraced by the overarching notion of covenant. I refer you to 7:19 and 22, 8:6 and 10:34. There is this superior new covenant that has been given in the person and ministry of Christ. And out of a sense of the superiority of this covenant, the writer emphasizes the multifaceted way in which Jesus is superior to the past. And number one, he does this by way of holding up Jesus' superiority to figures from the past. The prophets, chapter 1, verses 1 and following. Angels, 1:4. Moses, chapter 3, verse 3. Priests, chapter 7, verse 7. Jesus is not only superior to figures from the past, but he is also superior in his person and work to the whole priesthood and the sacrificial system. This is well established in chapter 7, 8, and 9 of Hebrews. Jesus' superiority to the priesthood as an institution and the sacrificial system operated by the priesthood. And then, interestingly enough, in a real mixing of imagery and metaphors in the presentation of Christ, Jesus is superior in his own sacrifice, the sacrifice of himself. He is not only a priest, the embodiment of the perfect embodiment of the priesthood and the sacrificial system. He is the sacrifice itself, and his sacrifice is a superior sacrifice. Once for all, it puts to rest the need for any further sacrifice. Chapter 9, verse 23. Now, all of these are very tightly intertwined in the doctrinal presentation of Hebrews with that of the covenant being what I would call an overarching common thread. Perhaps the book of Hebrews is to some extent responsible for the designation of this whole collection of writings that we're looking at called the New Testament or the New Covenant. In the book of Hebrews, Christ is presented in relation to his people. Christ is not only the heavenly priest who has offered himself as a heavenly sacrifice, but he is one who identifies in an intimate way with the people of God. He has been tempted to sin. He knows what our temptation is. He identifies with our common humanity. He is referred to even as our brother. There's a strong sense of identity of this exalted, crucified, risen Christ, this one who is superior in every way, a strong sense of his intimate identity with the people of God. Chapter 2, verses 7 to 18, chapter 4, verse 15, and chapter 5, verses 7 to 8. Now, there are some formal features associated with the writer's presentation of Jesus Christ. There's a strong typological use of the Old Testament. The best illustration of this is to be found in the 7th chapter, verses 1 and following, with the Melchizedek typology. Jesus has become, the fulfillment of various Old Testament types, and this is perhaps the most interesting and complex of these to be found in the book of Hebrews. In every way, Jesus is the fulfillment of Melchizedek, a type which foreshadows Christ in the Old Testament. The book of Hebrews presents ethics in some very distinctive ways. The life that is to be lived in conjunction with the theology of the epistle, the doctrinal presentation. Kesemann has written a book which captures something of the essence of the ethics of this people of this book. His monograph on the book of Hebrews is entitled "The Wandering People of God." You have a sense of people wandering, people on a journey. A picture of the people of God is on a journey. An emphasis upon the ephemeral nature of this current existence. The writer of Hebrews never mentions the temple, and all the emphasis upon the priesthood and sacrifice is not the temple he mentions, but the tent, the mobile structure that followed, that went with the children of Israel in the time of wilderness wandering, this unsettled time in Israel. This only reinforces all the more a sense of the people of God as a wandering people of God, for whom the structures and experiences of this life are not absolute. There's a provisional nature of the current to the current state of our existence, and it always points forward to something bigger and something greater. The writer of Hebrews emphasizes time and again the need for obedience, the need for endurance, the need for discipline, and all of these are theologically rooted in the great hope that is ours in Jesus Christ. Chapter 10, verses 19 to 25, chapter 11, verse 1, chapter 6, verses 13 to 20. Sometimes the writer of Hebrews emphasizes the terrible consequences of neglecting the great salvation that is ours. Speaks in a negative kind of way. Chapter 2, verse 3. Chapter 6, verses 4 to 8. Chapter 10, verses 26 to 31. And some of these portions have created some of the most difficult interpretative problems for the study of the book of Hebrews. But it seems to me that what's going on here is that the writer takes human responsibility very seriously. And some of our exegetical problems associated with the 6th and the 10th chapters of Hebrews are proportional to our own unwillingness to regard that responsibility, human responsibility, with the same seriousness with which the writer of Hebrews regards it. And in fact, to obey and to be faithful is very, very serious in the view of the writer of Hebrews, always, of course, in conjunction with the theological understanding and foundation that is laid in Jesus Christ. But the writer, nonetheless, without equivocation, emphasizes the importance of the imperatives, the responsibility of the Christian life. We might take an exegetical kind of look at this in the 13th chapter of Hebrews, verses 11 through 16. The writer says there, picking up with verse 11, "For the bodies of those animals," referring to the sacrificial system that once obtained, "whose blood is brought into the sanctuary by the high priest as a sacrifice for sin, are burned outside the camp. So Jesus also suffered outside the gate in order to sanctify the people through his own blood. Therefore let us go forth to him outside the camp and bear the abuse he endured. For here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city which is to come. Through him then let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God, that is, the fruit of lips that acknowledge his name. Do not neglect to do good and to share what you have, for such sacrifices are pleasing to God." In these few verses, we see a tremendous illustration of the fusion of theological and Christological vision with ethics and discipleship. Look at what the writer has done here in the presentation of Jesus as the one who suffered outside the gate in order to sanctify the people through his own blood. Suffered outside the gate, the city gate outside the temple, to redeem, sanctify the people through his own blood. And then there's an immediate ethical corollary to that realization. Therefore, let us go forth to him outside the camp and bear the abuse he endured. We see here the writer of Hebrews' own version of cruciform ethics, ethics that are shaped by the cross, by the suffering and death of the Lord Jesus Christ, without which there is no pathway to or appropriation of the power of the resurrection. Again, the cross is not just something to get through to a more significant event that we call the resurrection. Instead, the resurrection is that which gives the nod, so to speak, to the cross as what is to shape our lives and our existence. The only hope of our redemption is in the cross. Not only does the death of Christ redeem us from sin, but also it sets for us the pattern by which we are to live lives that are set free from sin. And we appreciate something of the power of the resurrection here and now, but we anticipate a more complete experience of the power of the resurrection in time to come. But the writer presents us with a life, a kind of ecclesiology of the church, going forth to Jesus outside the camp, ever going forth, ever going beyond its walls, not seeking a lasting city, but the city which is to come. There are some tremendous challenges here in these theological instructions for the church today, as she is tempted to hunker down with current structures and current programs rather than seeking ever to be responsive to the movement of the Spirit, ever looking beyond her doors to where God is active in our communities and throughout the world. Institutions and structures and programs can be good, but they can become so tight and so hardened into the life and ministry of the church that we find ourselves serving serving those programs and serving those institutions rather than them being tools in the hands of God to serve an ever-changing environment all around us, to serve in a way that brings faithful testimony to the Jesus Christ, who is the same yesterday, today, and forever, who is ever responsive to people and human need, bringing the glory of God to bear in our responsiveness and spiritual sensitivity to what is all about us. And the writer goes on, through him then let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God, that is the fruit of lips that acknowledge his name. Do not neglect to do good and to share what you have, for such sacrifices are pleasing to God. Here's the fusion of theological vision and ethics, worship and ethics, to raise hands and praise and worship without taking those same hands and engaging in ministry would be absolutely worthless to the writer of Hebrews. And so you've got a perfect example of the fusion of Christological vision, theological and doctrinal understanding, and ethics and discipleship here in these few verses. And I highly recommend them for the insight they give into the theology of this epistle as a whole. Please turn now to side B.